Hello again and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy. And this time we're crossing eons of time, or at least a couple of hundred years, trying to reimagine the sound of 18th century Dublin, which of course means much more than echoes of the Alleluia chorus, guiding us on our musical journey into HIP, or is that early music or original instruments, is Peter Whelan, Artistic Director of the Irish Baroque Orchestra. Whelan and the IBO have embarked on a project to find and play the music of 17th and 18th century Ireland. Earlier this year, Peter Whelan sat down with Culturefile to talk about that search and the long history of historically informed performance, and we'll do that as well as listen to some of that ancient music. But we began with the beginnings of Peter Whelan's own journey into ancient sound.
I remember that maybe the first historically informed performance I heard was probably on Lyric, or what it was called back in the day. And there were certain programs which I kind of taped off the radio, which I probably shouldn't have done. But I remember being really excited by the sound of certain recordings that I heard there, kind of begging my parents as a Christmas present to buy certain CDs. And I just remember the excitement of one particular recording of the Brandenburg Concertos by Musica Antiqua Köln, and going into... Arnott's used to have a CD store back in the day, and getting this particular music. The sound was a completely different world. I think I must have had some recordings with kind of modern instruments of the Brandenburg Concertos, and this just made sense. It kind of popped out of the speakers, and it just felt really fresh. In fact, it's quite a controversial recording, the Musica Antiqua Köln ones. They're very highly edited, and they're kind of they use all the latest technology in Germany at the time. So it feels really souped up and very dynamic. It's controversial. Some people think it's way too fast, and it's a very extreme version. But as a teenager, the kind of raw energy that came out really appealed to me. And then, of course, the journey began into trying to discover more about these instruments. It was hard in Ireland to find, you know, people who were playing these instruments, or how to even begin. I was playing piano at the time, studying with Valerie Walker, and then Gillian Smith, of course, is a harpsichordist. But the scene was particularly small in Ireland, and of course, you have to do your fescules and your normal exams. And it wasn't really until I finished studying. I did a degree in Trinity. Of course, I kind of lapped up lots of recordings, but it wasn't until after that that I went off to Basel, which is one of the homes of kind of early music. And there I met so many people from all over Europe, and there's a huge culture there of early music. I bought my first Baroque bassoon from a woman called Deirdre Nier in Cork, and so she had a beautiful Baroque bassoon, and I remember the day I went down to collect it from her, and she had been a player for years but felt a bit guilty about it sitting around, and I just remember it was the most wonderful thing. I just needed to find people to play it with, and it took a little bit of time. You have to kind of adjust your brain to play earlier instruments. It looks very familiar, but it's a much simpler version in many ways. It's kind of like getting back to basics with any particular instrument. Yeah, but so it took a little while to get going with that and to find my niche. There was a thing called the European Youth Orchestra European Union Baroque Orchestra, rather, which was really seminal in getting me started playing with other people.
Well, what is your preferred term here? Because there is a load of ways of describing historically informed, historical, original, and then Baroque is a word that covers your particular area. What are the kind of relative merits of those terms?
A term you come across a lot nowadays is HIP, which I suppose is historically informed performance or historically inspired performance. It depends which way you want to look at it. I quite like the historically inspired performance idea because it kind of takes away some of the dryness, you know, of the topic. I think it can seem a bit prohibitive to people from outside or overly academic. For the first 10 years of the movement, I suppose, from like David Munro and people kind of rediscovering all of these wonderful old instruments after the Second World War, I suppose it was a little kind of move back to try and find a new way or where we came from, especially after the kind of desolation in Europe of so much concrete and the way that people rebuilt things, quite a brutalist time, that they were looking for something that went further back or had maybe a little bit more European soul. So that was a very exciting moment. People were kind of dusting off these old instruments for the first time and rediscovering the new sounds. Even composers like Hindemith was really interested, and Stravinsky had really interest in this kind of older music and kind of making a renaissance of these new and different sounds. 20, 30 years after that, the movement became a little bit more formulaic. And it was more about what you shouldn't do rather than what you should do. And there was, of course, lots of money for recordings at that time, and there, people kept pumping them out. At the very beginning, people doing the early music movement were often the people doing contemporary music at the same time. So it was kind of interested and, I suppose, slightly hippie and out there musicians who were involved. But it became quite mainstream. Today it's the same. So you have your symphony orchestras and you have your early music orchestras, say the typical ones who might play Handel or Bach. But it's a very recognisable style and it's definitely not revolutionary anymore. Thank you. just within my generation, we're kind of moving on again in that there's other ways we can find inspiration from the past. For instance, it's not just the books written about how we should play. If you have to sit down and write a book about exactly how, for instance, Mariah Carey does her ornaments, it would take away a lot of the joy out of it. But if we're to look at poetry, pictures, paintings, or read newspaper articles about people, which is the case of these Irish musicians that I'm following, and kind of mix it into the culture and the architecture and the general feel of a place and time, then I think you have a more interesting product on lots of levels. There's a challenge when it comes to programming Baroque music. We have absolutely wonderful music by Bach and Handel, which needs to be heard all the time. It's some of the best music in the world. The danger is that we become limited to this, and audiences only want to hear this kind of music again and again. Like the classical music repertoire, for instance, you know, you want to hear your Beethoven symphonies or your Brahms cycles or your Mahler. Personally speaking, I always found it more interesting to search around the edges. There's plenty of wonderful music that never really gets a look in. I spent quite a few years recording some of these more unusual works. I've explored some music by Zelenka, a very interesting Czech composer, Fasch, who's an unknown German composer. This is all the time when I was doing mostly bassoon. And there were a few others, and then my attention kind of turned back to home, to Dublin, and what was going on here. I always had this fascination since I was a child about Messiah being performed in Dublin, and that iconic gable on Fishamble Street. It just kind of got my imagination going, what was going on there in 1742. Just as we discovered more about the backstory to Messiah, this project is going to explore what was going on in the world of music in Dublin at the time. So we're going to feature some music that would have been played in the theatres, including some excerpts from The Island Princess, which was the first semi-stage opera to be performed in Dublin. We were really interested to find out more about it. We found some dance numbers that were performed. But it was really surprising to see how bawdy they are. Like, they're very beautiful music, but some of the titles are really shocking to our ears nowadays and totally unpolitically correct. So you'd have no idea what you're listening to. It sounds like beautiful, sprightly dances, but the names are... The context within the opera are all... Actually, we're afraid to even write them in the program notes, but kind of very sexy and bawdy themes. the audience's taste back then were, I think you're kind of closer in Smock Alley Theatre. You're closer to Copperface Jacks as you will be nowadays than the Cathedral.
I'm guessing that one of the things that's very distinctive about the way you work and the way people working in historically informed performance work is this sort of close alliance with academic musicologists, because somebody is at the coal face and maybe you're shoveling the coal into the engine. Maybe is that a useful analogy? How does that relationship work?
The relationship between the performers and academia is extremely important, but there's a big split between the two worlds at the moment. I think academia is so far ahead and so specialized in their areas of research, and there's a kind of a disconnect with, or traditionally has been a disconnect with the performance world. I think that's part of the job description with Irish Baroque Orchestras, making connections with these academics and kind of joining the dots, because the music doesn't come alive really until people are playing it and there's an audience to listen to it. And this is very gratifying for the musicologists and for the musicians. It's a very kind of healthy relationship between the two. It seems that in academia that the people are becoming more and more specialised in different areas, and that might mean they're kind of becoming more disconnected from a central area. For the future, it'd be nice to see a kind of a space where those two could come together, seemingly worlds apart. But there's so much in common. There's been some interesting connections with musicologists. The first connection I made was with the Kusser project. Kusser was an amazing Hungarian-born musician who ended up in Dublin via everywhere. He studied in Versailles and then he was in London. I think he arrived in Ireland in the early 1700s. He's a fascinating character because he has a little diary belonging to him called his Commonplace Book, which is like a few hundred pages of details about life across Europe and especially about Dublin, which is totally unheard of. It's a little book that would have fit into his pocket, and is full of the addresses of musicians in Dublin, little potions and spells, you know, remedies, how to cure hangovers, how to cure warts, piles, the works. It's all in there. Also, how to get to London, how long it would take, how to book a theatre, the dimensions, what doors you'd have to lock in King's Hospital so the students wouldn't burst in and get free seats. Really fascinating details. And I remember getting really interested in this, and there's a Kiwi musicologist called Sam Owens. I remember just writing to her, I was playing bassoon at the time, and saying, do you think there's any music by Kusser for bassoon that I could discover a bit more about, you know, the kind of what was going on in Dublin at the time? And she said, well, there's a couple of things in this piece. You know, I found one of the Odes for Dublin Castle by Kusser, which I didn't know existed before, and it was like a I, of course, read about these composers in relation to Dublin, but there was always no music attached to them. So it's just kind of a coincidence. And that was kind of I suppose that got me started with directing. I said, well, nobody else is going to do this music, so I'm going to, you know, throw myself into it and try it myself, get some friends together, you know, use the harpsichord, do it the right way around. And we did put on a little concert in Dublin Castle where we recreated this piece. There was such a buzz around it for the musicians as well, that, you know, you're reuniting this music with its... the correct location, the correct country. And that was really, really good music. And there's so much to discover about it. It was like, it was clear he was trying to introduce, you know, French sophistication to the Irish court. That's kind of a different side of things. Thank you. The Irish State Music was a band of musicians who were based in Dublin Castle from the 1680s onwards. And there's little records of them that crop up all around the world. So we have Cusser's Commonplace Book, which lists all the people. But some musicologists in America have dug up some lists of who is playing. So you have a rough idea. It's about 10 musicians who played violins and can double woodwind instruments. There are also 6 state trumpeters and a kettle drum player. Only 2 of them could read music, so they're all astray. And then some of them were really hard work to keep in line. I guess they're quite drunk and unruly. They got paid much more than the string musicians, because traditionally a trumpet player would have to go out in the field in war and signal to the troops and could get shot at. That already was a very old-fashioned idea, but they still had the salary and some very nice kind of outfits that they get to wear as well. But as I said, they got paid in beer, and there's all kinds of stories about fights between them. When Cusser was brought over, there was an outrage with the local musicians. A guy called Rosengrave hated that a foreigner was being brought in, and he left the country immediately. But yeah, lots of colour and fascinating details from the time. We can go one of two directions after the exploration of music around the 1740s. The Irish Baroque Orchestra has a CD called Welcome Home, Mr. Dubourg, and that's about one of the masters of state music, Matthew Dubourg, who of course was an enormously charismatic character in Dublin, student of Gemignani, fantastic violinist, probably introduced Vivaldi's music to Ireland as well. Before him was Cusser, who we've covered a little bit, and we'll be doing some more work on him over the next few years. We can then look forward into the future. For instance, John Field, the famous composer of the Nocturnes, his father was a musician in the Irish State Music. I think we'll look forward at some point into the amazing singers who came to Ireland, including Tenducci, this castrato who ran away with a girl from Limerick and caused a big scandal. But that's another story. Or else we can look backwards, explore the earliest music we can find from about the time of the Restoration, so 1680s to 1700s, which is another fascinating time. There's plenty of music there to rediscover. Enormous amount of information about these people that's been overlooked, and it's just a huge pleasure, I suppose a personal pleasure, to kind of discover these characters. The more you read about them, the more you hear the music that they played, the formations that they were in, I just feel really privileged to know their stories, and I feel it's just so important to share this with people. It's something people don't know, and I think they could really invest in this knowledge. Every corner in Dublin I walk across now, I know something about the musical background of this, and it's something we could be really interested and proud in as well.
Peter Whelan, Artistic Director of the Irish Baroque Orchestra, on the future of the music of Old Dublin. And this autumn, the IBO will be on the road around Ireland with Tom Creed's production of Vivaldi's Griselda, the first Vivaldi opera to be performed in Ireland, which starts its tour at the Town Hall Theatre Galway on Saturday, October 12th. Meanwhile, as Peter mentioned, his latest CD with the IBO is Welcome Home, Mr. De Borg. The Culture File Weekly will be back at the same time, 7 p.m. next Friday. Till then, bye now.